The year is 1956, arguably one of the most mysterious contests in Eurovision history. 7 countries with 2 songs each, no televised recording of the show, and the EBU is hiding the scores. Was the EBU making it up as they went along, or is there a method to this madness? Find out in this week's episode of ESC 101. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever you are in the world, and welcome to ESC 101, your home of Eurovision history and obscurity. This is the podcast where we take a look at the Eurovision Song Contest throughout the years to uncover the hidden story behind the world's biggest music show. My name is Alexander, and welcome to episode 2. On today's show, we're going to be taking a look at the very first Eurovision Song Contest held in 1956. And specifically, we're going to be taking a look at the rules of the 1956 contest, because I have in my hands a translated copy of those rules, and we're going to be running through the highlights to see whether 1956 was the Wild West of Eurovision, or whether the EBU knew what they were doing all along. Let's jump right into it. The Eurovision Song Contest made its debut in Lugano, Switzerland, on May 24th, 1956. 7 countries took part that year: Belgium, France, West Germany, Italy, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, and Switzerland. We are very fortunate that we have a copy of the rules for 1956. There was a post on Reddit that had the French version, the original French version of the rules, and thankfully someone went and made an English translation of those rules. So we can actually see with an approximation what those rules mean. And so there are 3 main areas that we're going to be taking a look at in terms of the rules. What was the actual purpose of ESC? What was the purpose of the Eurovision Song Contest? What were the conditions of entering the contest? And how did the juries work? Because I know one of the biggest controversies of 1956 is the secrecy of the juries. So hopefully these rules are going to be revealing a little bit more about what the juries were like and how they operated. So to start off this week's episode, let's take a look at what the purpose of the Eurovision Song Contest was. There are 2 areas of the rules that talk specifically about the purpose of the Eurovision Song Contest, and they're in sections 2 and 4. And I'm going to be reading to you the English translation of those 2 sections. So section 2 reads, "This contest aims to encourage the production in the participating countries of original songs by provoking for this purpose by the international confrontation of their works and emulation among the authors and composers." And section 4 says, "The purpose of this contest is to encourage the production of original songs." Now, thankfully, section 4 is a lot more clear than section 2 when it comes to actually talking about the purpose of the Eurovision Song Contest. In this case, section 4 is simply stating, well, we want people to make original music, and this is a way to show off that music. That was basically the entire base premise of the Eurovision Song Contest. And it goes further in the earlier section, in section 2, where it goes a bit more into detail as to how the Eurovision Song Contest is to take place, what form it takes. So let's break it down. This contest aims to encourage the production. So we already have an idea that we're encouraging creativity in the participating countries. So obviously they're wanting to promote countries that are taking part in this show, of original songs by provoking for this purpose by the international confrontation of their works and emulation among the authors and composers. So international confrontation of the works, meaning an international competition, an emulation among the authors and composers. So an emulation is talking about having a performance of these songs in a venue. So allowing artists to interpret these songs live on a stage so that rather than listening to a studio recording, there's a live performance with an orchestra and a singer to bring these songs more to life. And of course, Eurovision has its origins in both radio and television. So this program would have been broadcasted onto television screens across the continent. And so showing off the musical talents of the various artists and the composers is essentially what Eurovision was designed to do. And it allowed for, in this case, they say international confrontation, but it really is international cooperation because these countries are sharing the same stage. And while, yes, the purpose of the Eurovision Song Contest is a contest to have confrontation or a competition, there's a certain level of collaboration that is built into the foundations of the Eurovision Song Contest. And this still rings true to this day. In 2023, the rules stipulate that it has to be an original song and that the song is not allowed to be commercially released before a certain date, in this case, September 1st, which of course was the date that we premiered this podcast. So we're officially in the new Eurovision season. And the very spirit of Eurovision in 1956 carries on to this day. So what were the conditions of actually entering the Eurovision Song Contest? Well, the rules don't actually give a lot, which I'm surprised and I'm also not surprised. There's pretty much only one actual rule that is to be followed in the Eurovision Song Contest in 1956. And that is that the duration of songs should not exceed 3 to 3.5 minutes. And note that the key word is should, not must. So if a song went over 3 to 3.5 minutes, then there's nothing much they can do. It's fascinating that they actually picked 3 to 3.5 minutes rather than just sticking with 3 or 2.5 or any other number. And to me, this could be an indication of either wanting to maintain a certain time frame of holding the contest because they don't want the songs to go on for ages, or maybe music industry experts thought that 3 minutes was a sweet spot for music and so they wanted to go with 3 to 3.5 minutes. But apart from that, there's no other restriction in terms of who participants are or how countries decide who represents them. There's no nationality rules, no identity rules, no language rules, no rules on the use of props or technically live animals is not written down. And there's a lot of flexibility when it comes to the show. Now, of course, countries recognize that it was a very small theater and there's only one camera person. So they recognize that they'd be limited as to what would be feasible to do on the stage, but there's no actual restrictions imposed. And on top of that, countries were encouraged but not required to use national finals to ensure that the broadcast had the broadest character of popularity when it came to the songs. And it's really fascinating to see that the contest in its infancy wanted the contest to represent the tastes of the people. And I know for some Eurovision fans that advocate for a televote-only system, this is kind of a big win for them because they can argue that Eurovision, from the very beginning, wanted to have the public's voice in the forefront. But of course, those who support the juries will then turn around and say, well, there's stipulations, the rules saying that juries need to vote. And of course, this is 1956. There's no telephone voting system that's even possible. You couldn't hold a referendum to choose which song the audience members liked. There was no feasible way of taking a public vote. So if the Eurovision Song Contest had a capability of producing a televote, I think they would probably go with it, considering the nature of the fact that they wanted countries to use national finals. Of course, they didn't require them because otherwise countries would complain, and so they left them as these suggestions. But the fact that this is a rule stipulated in the actual list of rules, I think, is really telling of the origins of Eurovision and that the role of the juries is technically, realistically, an element of the past. And of course, I'm not going to get into a full argument of juries versus televote versus both versus neither. because I have my own opinions. I don't want to voice them at this moment, but suffice to say, the jury in 1956 has its place. Putting that to the side, I think it's really fascinating to see that Eurovision has the people in mind and wants to have the greatest flexibility when it first starts, and that they learn over time what works and what doesn't work. And the fluid nature of Eurovision really speaks to the modernity of the contest. The fact that it's not necessarily completely stuck in its old ways. Again, people who are jury v. televote might argue otherwise. This is a big pioneering step for television. And, you know, whether you're a televoter or a jury supporter or neither or both, I think this is really important for us to have these discussions and to really understand the origins of the Eurovision Song Contest and to see that in reality, it's made for the people. It's not to appease national interests. It's not to appease governments or politicians, but it really is designed from the ground up to be a contest of the people. And the only other requirements in terms of actually entering the Eurovision Song Contest is that orchestral scores, a sound recording of the song and the text of the song in the original language, along with a translation into French and or English, was required. Now, some of these I get, especially for orchestral scores and sound recordings of the song. You need to get these in by a certain time so that the instrument players and other people can understand what they need to play and give them enough time to practice and things and to understand the tones of the music and stuff. But to actually have the text of the song in the original language along with the translation into French and or English, I think is really fascinating. And these translations were actually given to members of the jury. So the jury would have had access to the lyrics in the native language along with French and or English. And presumably these jury members would have a basic working knowledge of one of the languages so that they can actually take a look at what some of these lyrics mean and to develop a system where they can score these songs fairly. And of course, speaking of juries, let's take a look at how the juries worked. The juries were covered in sections 11, 12, and 13. And this is basically how the jury works. If you're dying to know what the 1956 song contest was like for jury members, here is your moment to shine and to revel in the facts. So each country sent two people at their own expense to sit on a single jury totaling 14 people. Now, already, this is really fascinating that the EBU is forcing countries to fit the bill when it comes to sending their own jury members. So I'd be curious to see who jury members were and where they lived, whether like France, for example, would send people that lived close to the Swiss border, or people that lived in Lugano could just simply go to the theater and not have to worry about paying for extra transportation costs. If you're not already aware of this fact, Switzerland actually had to sub in some jury members for Luxembourg because they weren't able to send any jury members to Switzerland. And I don't exactly know why, whether it was a financial constraint or they fell sick or they got delayed because their car or train got canceled or whatever, I don't know. But Switzerland actually had to send jury members on behalf of Switzerland. And I don't know if the honor system was held up. I don't know if the Swiss jury members were like, we have Luxembourgish backgrounds, or if they just picked random Swiss people and were just like, you're gonna sit for Luxembourg, even if you don't have any connection to the country. And they're like, okay. These 14 people would be sitting in a room together and would vote to elect a president and two scrutineers by secret ballot. So the group chose from amongst themselves who would be the president and the scrutineers. We do know that the president of the jury was Rolf Liebermann. He was born in Zurich, Switzerland. And while we don't know whether Mr. Liebermann was one of the Swiss jurors, one of the jurors representing Luxembourg, or a juror representing a different country altogether, because if you'll remember, there were no nationality stipulations in the rules, we do know that he is the president because he was called onto the stage to announce the winner at the end of the interval act. So with a Swiss-born president and the possibility of two other Swiss-born scrutineers, it is entirely possible that Switzerland held the leadership position within the jury, but that kind of borders into speculation and even conspiracy theory. And to keep an eye on these people, both the president, the scrutineers, and the rest of the jury members, the EBU provided a 15th person, and they were designated to be the secretariat. And this individual would be a neutral person. So again, I don't know the nationality of this individual. I don't know if they were a national citizen of one of the participating countries, or maybe they were British or Monegasque or any number of other countries that were in Europe at the time. They would basically be the neutral party that would oversee everything. The way that jury members actually judged the show is that they were meant to judge the performances by watching a small television screen in conditions resembling a family living room. So rather than sitting at a desk or a boardroom with TV screens or watching it live in the audience, jury members actually sat in a living room and watched a television as if they were in their own home. And again, this is another element where the Eurovision Song Contest really was for the people. This was a perfect example of jury members being forced into a situation where they are like any other member of the public, where the common audience member would have been sitting in their living room, either watching or listening to the show and enjoying the songs in a family room. And to actually have jury members placed in this sort of environment, I think is really telling as to what the EBU wanted for Eurovision. They didn't want stuffy politicians dictating what music to love, but rather they wanted to resemble a public vote as much as possible. And so by placing jury members in a family living room style space with a small television screen, this was as close as they could get to a public vote. And what's really odd was that the audience in the room that was not jury members, but actual audience members in the show, were not actually allowed to leave the room during the deliberation process of the jury, with an interlude taking place during the voting process to keep audience members entertained. Now, I don't know if this rule was followed to the letter, because I imagine if there's like an audience member that needed to go to the bathroom, then surely they would have been allowed to leave and go to the bathroom. Maybe they had to be supervised. And I know that there's no rule now that audience members have to stay in the arena during the voting process. You can just leave at any point, as far as I'm aware. So I don't fully understand the logic. I mean, perhaps they don't want audience members to sway the jury, or maybe they didn't want some like insider knowledge to be given to jury members and to like sort of corrupt their view of the contest. But I thought that was really fascinating that the audience was actually not allowed to leave. So the ways that jury members actually voted was they had an ad hoc ballot, meaning that the ballot was only to be used for this contest and not to be used for future contests. And they rated each of the songs presented from 1 to 10 in ascending order of their appreciation. So this is the way that the rules were translated, and it's kind of a little confusing for me because it could go in one of two ways. Either they rate every single song individually from 1 to 10, or they rank the collection of songs from like their top 10. So there might be some songs that are ranked 11th, 12th, 13th, and 14th, or each song was given a minimum score of 1, so scores were added together. Now, I personally think that it's the first option, that each song had to give a score from 1 to 10, which I feel is very similar to the system used in 1973, where every single song had to be ranked from 1 to 5, and you had like two jury members to give their individual scores. But it's fascinating to see that in this scenario, there are jury members giving their scores from 1 to 10, and assuming they follow this system of ranking each individual song from 1 to 10, and you have 14 jury members, that would indicate that if Liz Assia's song Refrain got 102 points, as reported in the La Stampa newspaper, which if you didn't hear about that, then check out my last episode, the premiere episode, where I talked about that briefly in the Song of the Week segment. hypothetically, you could get to 102 points if you did in that system, but you would require 10 jury members to give 10 points, and then one jury member to give two, and then that would leave three more jury members to, like, not... Well, I guess that wouldn't work anyway, because you have to give a minimum of one. So, mathematically, I think it could work out if you, like, spread the numbers around and Liz Assia had high points across all the jury members, including the jury members who could technically vote for their own country, because there's also no rule stipulating that you had to vote for countries other than your own, which, again, would make sense if you're following the first segment where every song has to be ranked from 1 to 10. If you were following the second one where it's like your top 10, then you could just automatically place your countries like 13, 14, so it'd be out of the running. But I don't know. Again, not a lot of detail. I'm going to assume it's the first method where you have to rank each individual song, but maybe somebody out there knows better than I do. Not a robotic encyclopedia, but I do try my best to interpret some of these rules and stipulations. So, interesting things to think about. So, the votes themselves were written down on ballots, and the ballots were collected anonymously, and the president, along with two scrutineers, counted the votes and established the results based on a strictly mathematical method of points awarded to each song. So with the scrutineers and the president counting the votes, there's some level of accountability, which kind of goes out the window if everybody is Swiss, but we'll assume that they weren't all Swiss and that they were from different countries. And even if they were all Swiss, then you still have the EBU member there to kind of watch things over. So we're going to assume that the count was honest and, you know, optimism and positivity. All of these votes were counted and based on a strictly mathematical method of points awarded to each song. So they basically just added up song points. And it's like, this song got X amount of points. And they would just say the song with the most points wins, second most points gets second, et cetera, et cetera. There was no actual tie-breaking rule. And they make references to this throughout the actual rules that there might be multiple winning songs, like with the S in brackets. So it was entirely possible to have more than one winner. And the final ranking is to be immediately announced, and the broadcast of the contest shall end with a reprise of the winning songs. And yeah, they actually wrote it down in the rules that they would not announce the scores. Again, I don't know why they wouldn't want that, especially for like transparency purposes. I imagine that maybe they wanted to keep the contest time short. They don't want to like overrun on time. But I think it's important to be transparent in these sorts of situations. So I don't know why the EBU decided not to show off the scores. Maybe it was like they thought it was too scandalous for 1956 and they just decided to announce the winner and that was that. But I know that if I was an audience member, I'd want to see the scores just to be like, okay, you know, make sure we're playing by the rules fair and stuff. But you got to put your faith in the system at the time. And the EBU was there to make sure that things ran smoothly. And that was that. So that is the highlight reel of the rules of the 1956 contest. Of course, there's other rules in terms of like how to broadcast it and what the rights of non-participating countries are and all that sort of stuff. But these are sorts of the highlights of the rules, how to get into the Eurovision Song Contest, how the juries worked. And these are sort of the controversial points that 1956 is kind of infamous for. If there's some questions that are still remaining, then I apologize for not being able to answer those questions. But hopefully this insight into the rules gives you a better idea as to how the 1956 contest actually operated and how the rules impacted the way that the contest transformed over the years and how even some of those rules carried over to this day. And so after hearing about the rules of the 1956 contest, let's turn our attention to some Eurovision news. It's time for the Eurovision Report.
Thank you.
the Eurovision event entitled Eurovision Choir has been cancelled for the foreseeable future by the European Broadcasting Union. Eurovision Choir joins other shows like Eurovision Young Dancers and Eurovision Dance Contest on the creative back burner of the EBU. The Eurovision Choir is a contest that has been held twice before. Latvia hosted the inaugural edition in 2017 and Sweden in 2019, and the pandemic caused the cancellation of 2021, and the EBU had not continued any plans for further editions of the competition. It is unfortunate that some of these Eurovision projects are not coming to fruition, and there's no indication whether there will be any future renditions of Eurovision Choir or anything like it. This is reported by Timothy Holdiness of ESC Extra. The American Song Contest has officially been cancelled, according to Christopher Bjorkman, one of the contest's organizers. This story originally broke in February 7th of 2023, but news of the American Song Contest has gone extremely quiet, indicating that there are no future plans to renew for a second season or a new rendition of the show. And while the contest was hosted by megastars Kelly Clarkson and Snoop Dogg, the viewership didn't capture the numbers that they were expecting, and the future of various spin-offs are on hold. This is reported by Timothy Holdiness of ESC Extra. This has been the Eurovision Report. So, we've just learned about the Eurovision Song Contest rules of 1956, and we just heard some Eurovision news. Now it's time to turn our attention to this week's Song of the Week. This is the part of the show where I explore a Eurovision entry that fascinates me, repulses me, makes me question my life choices, and maybe even gets me into a little bit of a groove. Let's learn more about this week's Song of the Week. The entry chosen for this week is the Finnish entry from 1989, La Dolce Vita, translated as The Good Life, sung by Anneli Saristo, composer Matti Partinen, lyricist Turka Mali, and conducted by Ossi Runne. It ended up placing 7th, getting 76 points, 10 points from France, Israel, Turkey, and Yugoslavia, 8 points from Ireland, and various points from 7 other countries. This song is a very Spanish-sounding song, or at least a very Latin-inspired song, with an Italian title sung in Finnish. And this song is very opposite to last week's Song of the Week, where Refrain was a story about tragedy and melancholy, but sung in a beautiful way. This is very much the opposite of that, where this is like, I am living my good life and I want to celebrate. And this is very much a little bit of a party bop. For me, I absolutely love Finland in the 80s. I think that a lot of their entries were fantastic, and this is definitely no exception. La Dolce Vita is so much fun. I absolutely love dancing to this entry, not understanding a single thing that she's singing because I don't speak Finnish. But I think when we look at some of the lyrics translated, I think you'll kind of get where the song is going. So some of the lyrics translated from Finnish read something like this. The good life, it has all been so sweet. The good life, no need for tears. I was just quenching life's thirst. I knew how to plead for happiness after everything. All I can say is the good life. This song is a lot of fun. I really encourage you to listen to this song and to let me know what you think about it. There's a lot of fun entries out there, and I think this is definitely one of them. So, we managed to uncover a bit of the mystery behind the 1956 contest. While we don't have a televised recording available to watch, I hope that this insight into the rules of the contest help provide you with a little bit of context next time you listen to the 1956 contest. Of course, you can find us on Instagram if you'd like to get in touch. We are ESC101 Podcast. send me your thoughts, your comments, what you thought about the episode or this week's song of the week. Or if you have any topic suggestions that you'd like me to look at, then I'd be happy to take a look and see what ideas you have. Or if you'd like to get in touch with us via email, you can get in touch by esc101podcast@gmail.com. So loads of ways to get in touch. Thank you so much for listening. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss the next episode where we sound the alarm as the Eurovision stage gets invaded. You have been listening to ESC 101. See you next time.